Good evening. Department of Education says new rules will make it easier for men accused of sexual abuse on college campuses, but women say they'll sue. A city report says nearly a million will lose their jobs and the first night of subway closures in more than 100 years. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with some of the news for Wednesday, May 6th, 2020. A new report by the liberal think tank, the Hamilton Project, finds since the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic, food insecurity has increased in the United States, especially for households with young children. The report finds by the end of April, more than 20% of households in the United States and 40% of households with mothers and children under 12 were food insecure. Food insecure was defined as an affirmative answer to the questions your household didn't get enough food or that children were not eating enough because you couldn't afford food. The report's results show the highest level of food insecurity in the nearly 20 years food insecurity has been surveyed in the United States. Other surveys have found more than 17% of U.S. children not getting enough to eat. Inadequate nutrition can leave young children with permanent developmental damage. And earlier today, Education Secretary Betsy DeVos issued final rules on how all schools will address allegations of sexual misconduct. The new rules undo the guidelines of the Obama administration and give students and faculty accused of misconduct new protections. The new rules modify Title IX, a 1972 law prohibiting discrimination based on sex in education programs or activities that receive federal financial assistance. Emily Martin is Vice President of Education and Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center.
Us and the Trump administration have been very clear that through these rules, they want to reduce the number of complaints of sexual harassment in schools. And these rules are designed to do just that. They're designed to send the message to survivors of sexual harassment and sexual assault that there's no point in complaining because it's not going to help.
What's going on the college campuses today? Is this a result of frat boy culture?
Sexual harassment and, in particular, sexual assault remains incredibly common in our culture generally and on college campuses in particular. We are still struggling with a race culture that doesn't take consent seriously and that doesn't take women and girls seriously.
Yep.
The Department of Education, however, has chosen to take steps to make schools less safe. The timing of the release of this rule is really egregious. Schools are supposed to implement the rule by August of this year. They have no bandwidth to make the sorts of wholesale amendments to their processes that this rule would require, and it's dangerous to ask them to do so.
They seem to present it, their point of view as behind these rules, as these rule changes, as too petty, too small-minded, didn't give enough of a reason for somebody to defend themselves. Is that what this is about?
What the Trump administration seems to be saying is that schools have been taking sexual assault too seriously. I think that that's fundamentally misguided. I think the approach that these rules are taking is fundamentally misguided. What the rules do is create a whole new set of really difficult, arduous procedures, quasi-criminal trial requirements that apply only in the context of allegations of sexual harassment and sexual assault. It sends the message that somehow those who speak out about sexual harassment and sexual assault are uniquely unreliable. And that is a really toxic, dangerous, and baseless message that reflects deep-rooted skepticism that sexual assault even occurs. It just shows a real disconnect with the realities in schools and in the culture.
Is there going to be a response to this, a legal response?
We will be challenging these rules in court, and we intend to win. And I think, frankly, that you're going to see multiple lawsuits challenging these rules as a unlawful effort that really twists and distorts what Title IX intends.
Legally, from your perspective, what should consent mean?
the hard question that these rules actually affirmatively sidestep. The rules say they're not going to offer a definition of consent, but what is quite clear is that Title IX prohibits sexual harassment when it has the effect of interfering with a student's ability to access an education. And these rules take us backward and weaken those protections in ways that will lead to many students, and in particular many women and girls, being pushed out of school entirely.
When somebody says something demeaning in a classroom, it's serious.
It is serious, and it's also the case that what we want schools to do is to intervene early on, before harassment gets to a point that it's impacting somebody's ability to succeed in school. And these rules prohibit schools from taking steps to address sexual harassment while it is still a matter of a few comments, while it is still something that can be nipped in the bud. It requires schools to do nothing until the problem has become so big that it's compromising students' ability to get an education.
Emily Martin is Vice President of Education and Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. In a statement, President Trump, who has had his own brushes with sexual harassment allegations, said, "With today's action and every action to come, the Trump administration will fight for America's students." The new rules take effect in August. The COVID-19 epidemic continues to spread around the world. There have been 3.7 million cases globally and more than 257,000 deaths that are known. More than 1.2 million of the cases are in the United States, and more than 71,000 are known to have died. On Wednesday, Trump backed away from Tuesday's announcement. He was shutting down his coronavirus task force, whose members include the country's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci.
"That we could wind it down sooner, but I had no idea how popular the task force is until actually yesterday. When I started talking about winding it down, I'd get calls from very respected people saying, I think it would be better to keep it going. It's done such a good job. The task force will be around until we feel it's not necessary. So let's keep it going. And so we'll be doing that. But we'll be adding some people to it. We'll be announcing, I would say by Monday, we'll be announcing two or three new members to the task force."
The president has been aggressively pushing the states to reopen after a month-long shutdown brought about by the COVID-19 pandemic. It was in the city of Wuhan in China that the first cases of COVID-19 were detected. Wuhan is also the site of a Chinese government biology lab, like many thousands of similar labs in the United States. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said Sunday there is, quote, enormous evidence the virus came from a lab in the Chinese city of Wuhan. But most intelligence and military experts, including the chief of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, say the source of the virus was most likely nature and not China's lab. Today, Pompeo sparred with reporters on the subject.
"And a second question,
Barbara, let me just put this to bed. Your efforts to try and find, just to spend your whole life trying to drive a little wedge between senior American officials, it's just false.
Barbara,
every one of those statements is entirely consistent. Every one of them. Lay them down together. There's no separation. I'm not sure what it is that about the grammar that you can't get. We don't have certainty, and there is significant evidence that this came from the laboratory. Those statements can both be true. But focus on the most important piece here. The American people remain at risk. I hope we get an answer. Where did patient zero begin? Where precisely did this start? I hope we get even more evidence about where it came from. And when we do, we'll certainly make that clear as well."
Last week, U.S. intelligence officials issued a rare public statement saying they agree with the global scientific consensus that the virus originated in an animal, but will continue to investigate if it was the result of an accident in a lab. And closer to home, New York State and New York City have both reported decreasing daily incidents of COVID-19 cases for the third consecutive day, the lowest number of new cases since March 18th. The state also reports the percentage of positive tests for virus antibodies continues to decline. That's according to the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. But the disease continues a steady march around the world, with hotspots detected in rural areas of the United States and new cases in Africa and Latin America, as well as outbreaks in India. In his daily report, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo recounted some findings from a study of 1,000 hospital admissions in the state. Most of the results were expected, a higher rate of hospitalizations among Black and Latino people. But other findings of who ends up in the hospital were unexpected.
Overwhelmingly, the people were at home, where there's been a lot of speculation about this. A lot of people, again, had opinions. A lot of people have been arguing where they come from and where we should be focusing. But if you notice, 18% of the people came from nursing homes. Less than 1% came from jail or prison. 2% came from the homeless population. 2% from other congregate facilities. But 66% of the people were at home, which is shocking to us. Disproportionately older. But by the way, older starts at 51 years old. I'm a little sensitive on this point. But if older starts at 51 years old, then that's a large number of us old folk in this state, in this country. So that whole vulnerable population being old, well, old is now 51 and up. So think about that. 60 to 70, 20%, 70 to 80, 19%. But 51 years old is old. Okay. Then I am very old. Transportation method, we thought maybe they were taking public transportation, and we've taken special precautions on public transportation, but actually no, because these people were literally at home. 2% took car services, 9% were driving their own vehicle. Only 4% were taking public transportation, 2% were walking. 84% were at home, literally. Were they working? No. They were retired or they were unemployed. Only 17% working. So that says they're not working, they're not traveling, they're predominantly downstate, predominantly minority, predominantly older, predominantly non-essential employees. Much of this comes down to what you do to protect yourself. Are you wearing the mask? Are you doing the hand sanitizer? Are you staying away from older people? Older starting at 51, by the way.
Meanwhile, New York City's economy continues to reel under the effects of the pandemic. A report released today by Comptroller Scott Stringer says the city is looking at nearly $9 billion budget gap and unemployment not seen since the Great Depression.
We're going to have 900,000 people who are not working, people who were previously employed. We're going to have budget gaps as large as $9 billion, and we're going to have lost revenue of $7 billion. But what does all those numbers mean? It means that we're going to have to fight hard for federal assistance. New York City sends $35 billion more to the federal government than we get back from the federal government. We need the government to understand that New York is the epicenter of our economy, that without New York, the rest of the nation will not grow. We are at the epicenter of this crisis, and we need federal aid. But right now, believe it or not, New Yorkers are getting $9,000 per case from the feds. Montana is getting $2.7 million, even though they have relatively few cases. This is just not acceptable. But we also need the city government to step up and make sure every dollar counts, get rid of these programs that are not helping working people and poor people, and make sure we put in place ways to help our frontline workers, to help people who've been hit hardest by the COVID crisis, people of color, people in the Bronx and Queens. We need to rethink how we budget in this town, and we need to do it quickly.
Disparities. You talk about disparities in coronavirus and treatment of coronavirus victims. What does that mean, and how will that be reflected in the budget?
Well, this virus goes after the people who are weakest health-wise. It goes after the elderly, but it also goes after people with pre-existing conditions like diabetes, like heart issues, obesity issues. The city has never fairly funded our communities, communities of color, who have suffered from these ailments for a very long time, people in public housing who had to deal with lead and mold. All of this contributes to underlying conditions. So we need a city budget that's going to reflect the rebuilding of our neighborhoods and our communities. I do believe Wall Street will emerge from this just fine. The big companies like Amazon are going to do just fine. But at the end of the day, what will make New York is our ability to transform our communities in the midst of this pandemic.
How would the city, in an extended, if this does not come back when we open up the city, what are we going to do?
Look, we are in the midst of a recession, and it's growing by day. This economy literally shut down. We lost $7 billion in revenue. This virus has hit hardest our struggling communities. We have frontline workers like nurses and doctors and grocery workers who are putting their lives on the line every day. Having said that, of course New York can come back. You know, I was born and raised in this town in the 1970s when the city was on the edge of bankruptcy. And I still remember as a kid people giving up on New York, and they made a big mistake and they lost that bet. New York comes back bigger and stronger than ever, but the decisions we make now will impact the future of this city. So, yes, I think we can jumpstart this economy. I think we have to do it safely. I think we need massive testing, and we need New York City ingenuity now more than ever, but we can get there. And my office is going to continue to speak truth to power to let New Yorkers know the state of our economy and what they need to know for us to get to a better place.
New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer. The sectors of the city economy with the biggest job losses are hotels, restaurants, retail, healthcare, construction, and the arts. A poll by the Associated Press finds the imprint of the economic impact of the pandemic hitting people of color the hardest. With Latinos being hit hardest of all, 61% of Latinos say they've lost income because of the pandemic, compared to 46% of Americans overall. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. In more New York City news, beginning last night and for the first time since the 1880s when streetcars were introduced, New York City's transportation network was closed overnight for an indeterminate period to disinfect subway cars. The move came on orders from Governor Cuomo and was heartily embraced by Mayor Bill de Blasio. At 1 o'clock this morning, police, MTA, and homeless services workers descended onto the subways, waking up and evicting homeless people who've made the empty cars their homes during the pandemic. The mayor says it was a big success because more than 100 agreed to go to shelters.
If in one night 139 people took a step towards leaving that life and coming in to a safe haven or a shelter and starting the process of getting to long-term housing and never going back on the streets, that's an extraordinary number for one night and very encouraging. We have to sustain it in many, many ways. We've got a lot of work to do. But I want to say to everyone involved, to the NYPD, to everyone at Social Services and Homeless Services, to the MTA, to the governor's team, we all worked together on this vision in hopes it would create something new. And the very first night, we see a very hopeful sign.
Since the city was shut down by the coronavirus, subways have been at 90%, have been 90% emptier, with only essential workers allowed to ride. The MTA says it's for the health of their workers. More than 100 transit workers have died from COVID-19. But the deputy executive director for policy at the Coalition for the Homeless, Giselle Ruthier, says the state and the city are doing all the wrong things.
Certainly a new era, but it's a very disturbing new era. In terms of offering people access to congregate shelters, it's actually not the right approach right now. We've now been in this crisis for months, and the coronavirus is spreading throughout the shelter system. We know from multiple sources and health officials that congregate shelters are not safe, and that is why people have been taking refuge in the subways. What the governor and the mayor need to be offering people on the streets is access to private hotel rooms, so that they will come in and have a safe place to be.
The newspaper accounts I read, New York Times, Daily News, seemed to really describe what was going on. And what I expected was that people were just told by the police to get out of the subway. And some were crying and very upset about it and went off into the night, which is what to be expected. Then the mayor later on in his press conference addressed encampments and that they're going to break up encampments. Are they saying that go into a shelter or you'll just never sleep anywhere?
Yeah, I mean, the level of harassment at this point is extreme. And again, I think the most important point for everybody to remember is that the city is not offering homeless people a safe place to go. They are offering transport to a congregate shelter. In the case of single men, it's an 850-bed shelter that's been in operation for decades. And for women, same thing. Shelters that have hundreds of beds that are shared bathrooms and shared dining facilities, that is not safe. We need to be offering people direct access to private rooms with private bathrooms so that they can self-isolate in the way that people who are housed have the ability to do so. It's just really concerning the level of police presence that was out last night and the indication that there will be continued police presence in various forms for people on the streets without any option of a safer place to go.
What's going on? Do they have some plan that they want to use this coronavirus crisis to finally eliminate New York's homeless problem, visible homeless problem?
Many mayors have and governors have taken the, go back to Giuliani, I mean, the issue for politicians a lot of times is getting people out of the view of the public so they're not being blamed for societal ill, but that's not effective because what it does is move people further into the shadows. And when we're talking about doing that in the midst of a viral pandemic where people are exposed to an illness that could kill them, it's even more reprehensible. I can't think of a word other than reprehensible for what the mayor and governor are currently doing for people who are homeless and on the streets. It's being portrayed as this great thing when people are being roused from sleep, moved onto the streets, into the elements, not offered a safe private space to go, and shuffled around the city, all while being traumatized and scared for their own health and safety.
One of the newspaper articles did mention that. I have to give the New York Times credit. They had a person where they actually covered the fear that they're feeling going out into the street and begging to be allowed back into the subway. What is the situation of the people who live in the subways? What kind of people are living in the subways and how should they be approached? And are the police the right people to do that?
Police are definitely not the right people to do that because the tools they have in their toolbox are, you know, related to the criminal justice system, summonses, arrests, move on orders. That's not what we mean. People that are on the subways are all different kinds of people. Some people are newly homeless and are coming to the streets because they lost their unstable housing as a result of the pandemic. Some people have a serious mental illness and have been homeless for many years, and everything in between. So I think that what the underlying factor here is that people are struggling to find spaces that they feel are safe. And we need the city to offer those spaces in the way that they're offering to other populations of people who are not homeless.
What's the plan? What are you suggesting the city should do?
Hotels, hotels, hotels. That's the main thing that needed to happen weeks ago, but we can still do it. We can still give people safe spaces to be. We need to offer people private spaces with private bathrooms so that they can actually take care of their basic needs, get off the streets and out of the transit system, and have a place to shelter and take care of themselves and prevent the spread of coronavirus. It's really that simple. And if we take that step, we'll be moving forward in a really healthy way toward the end of the pandemic, and we'll be setting people up for much better options in the long term.
Giselle Routhier is Deputy Executive Director for Policy at the Coalition for the Homeless. Many of last night's 11,000 subway riders were trying to get either to or from work and were blindsided by the closing. The city had extra buses to take up the slack, and officials said they would do better in the nights to come. And simultaneous rallies were held across New York on Wednesday, organized by advocates for alternatives to solitary confinement. They demanded the state legislature reconvene to pass the Halt Solitary Confinement Act. The protesters, who practice social distancing while broadcasting their action over the web, say solitary confinement continues to be a cruel and inhuman form of punishment in New York State's prisons and jails. Assemblymember Harvey Epstein is a longtime supporter of the Halt bill. He also represents the Lower East Side District, where 32-year-old Donnie Wright and two others were arrested in an altercation over mask wearing over the weekend. He says an improper arrest could lead to a death sentence in solitary confinement.
It's a human rights violation. You know, and we see this happen all the time, how black and brown communities are directly impacted. Just in my district over the weekend, people know about the story of a constituent of mine, someone who has a full-time job, works for public housing, is an essential worker, lives in my community, and was just on the street corner, was brutally attacked by a police officer, was arrested, charged with a felony, and put into jail. Luckily, with the advocacy of all of our work, and that was videotaped. The prosecutor, district attorney's office, decided not to prosecute that case. But the person spent time, you know, in jail, could have been sent to Rikers, and could have been subject to so many tortures, just like solitary confinement does. We need to look at this as a healthcare crisis. Solitary confinement is creating a healthcare crisis, mental health crisis, physical health crisis. We should be letting people go, not putting them into solitary. I urge my colleagues, I urge our leadership to bring us back into session, to get this going so we can pass this bill. This is impacting thousands of New Yorkers and tens of thousands of families, the people who understand the solitary is killing them.
Assemblymember Harvey Epstein. In related news, activists in New York released a statement in response to a report in Mother Jones that incarcerated people in New York state prisons are making hundreds of thousands of face masks for pennies on the dollar and are prevented by the Department of Prisons from wearing the masks themselves to protect against contracting COVID-19. They said it's outrageous that Governor Cuomo is forcing incarcerated New Yorkers, disproportionately black and brown, to make hundreds of thousands of essential face masks while preventing them from wearing them. Above all else, the governor needs to grant broad clemencies to New Yorkers in prison to stop the spread of the virus. If the governor fails to act, incarcerated New Yorkers, the vulnerable, infirm, and aging will needlessly lose their lives because of his failure to do what is right, unquote. And finally, a federal judge ruled that New York's June 23rd Democratic presidential primary must be reinstated. On April 27th, the New York State Board of Elections canceled the presidential part of New York's primary, saying the election was moot since Sanders has suspended his campaign on April 8th. That's Bernie Sanders, the Vermont senator, and was at one time the front runner. The board also argued that amid the coronavirus epidemic, it was safer that people not gather at poll sites. In response, 3 days later, Andrew Yang, who dropped out of the presidential race February 11th, filed a federal lawsuit demanding that the presidential primary be reinstated. The Sanders delegates were represented by Village District Leader and WBAI host Arthur Schwartz. The plaintiffs called the decision a victory for democracy. The city says it's planning a possible appeal. And that's some of the news for Wednesday, May 6th. 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.